Okay, this evening we're going to be looking at the issue of Israel's zeal for God that's not in accordance with knowledge and what that resulted in. We looked at that verse last week and we considered Paul's explanation for the term zeal for God and its automatic corollary in another place of ever learning and never able to come to the knowledge of the truth. We saw that Paul's desire for Israel's salvation wasn't because they had any kind of latent good in them called a zeal for God, but it was rather because he had been precisely where they were with this ignorant zeal that was in theory for God, but was actually fundamentally wrapped up in themselves. And in their zeal, they actually were adversaries of God, because they were persecuting his church and persecuting his apostles and all of that kind of thing. So Paul wasn't saying that he had a desire for them to be saved because they had this latent good thing in them called a zeal for God. The only problem with it was that it was ignorant. Their zeal was actively evil, and it was very self-promoting, and it was in direct contradiction to any kind of real zeal for God. So, because Paul had been in that condition, and an enormous alienation from God while attempting to prove to himself and everybody else that he was in love with God and was serving God. Just like Jesus had said, there will come a time when they will put you to death thinking they're serving me. But anyway, Paul, having been there, had a kind of sympathy for them that perhaps another person wouldn't have, having never been in that situation. But because he had been as blind as they were, he had been more zealous than they were. He had been caught by his own terrible blind hypocrisy. He felt an empathetic sympathy for them, even though he was the object of their persecution. He understood that perfectly. But because of his past, he had a stirred desire and prayer to God that they might be saved. So this evening we're going to look at verse 3, where he explains what he meant when he said that they have a zeal but it's not according to knowledge, because that's what the 4 means. He's going to give us a rationale. It's, I think, his claim in this verse that Israel's ignorance sponsored an overweening pride and a deep hostility to the gospel, but that remains to be seen. We'll see if we can establish that idea as we go through it. The main idea in verse 3 is righteousness. It's found in the phrase, not knowing about God's righteousness, and they did not subject themselves to the righteousness of God. And I think the King James actually inserts it in the phrase, seeking to establish their own righteousness. But that's an insertion. So technically there are 2 references, direct statements about righteousness in this verse, which is only about 17 words long. So it's pretty clear that he zeroed in on the righteousness of God. And in addition, the whole idea is that they didn't know about God's righteousness in either of 2 ways, because Paul started out the book of Romans in chapter 1 talking about there is in the gospel a righteousness that is from God implied to men, because it says here they didn't receive it. The Gentiles in verse 30 who weren't pursuing righteousness received it, and the Jews who were pursuing a law didn't receive it, and they didn't arrive at the righteousness. But the point is that there is a righteousness that is of God. It's his perfect, absolute perfection in the area of righteousness, which is fundamentally associated with how you treat other people. There is a word, godliness, which has to do with how much like God a person might be in terms of mimicking his glory or his character or his behavior or something along that line. And that's the idea of godliness. But the idea of righteousness is more lateral. It's more how you treat somebody else, whether you treat them like they justly need to be treated. And that can be a positive and a negative, depending on whether they deserve to be treated justly because they've done well, or because you treat them justly because they've done evil. So there is that. But in the gospel of Romans 1:16-17, the issue there is that there is this righteousness that is of God, but is also from God to men, because the promise of the gospel is that you can have this righteousness attributed to yourself. You can be declared righteous by God, who is righteous. And that's the point that's in chapter 3, where he says that God wanted to be just and justifier. He wanted to be righteous. It's the same word. And he also wanted to be able to declare people righteous, even though they weren't. So that was the tension in Romans 3, and that tension is resolved by the death of Christ as a champion of the human race, a new Adam, where he takes on their sin and his righteousness is attributed to them. So when you have this righteousness thing attached to the phrase of the God, technically it's a righteousness that's infinite. And because it's infinite, it's always and ever going to be far, far, far beyond the comprehension of any finite created brain. Even men in their glorified bodies are still going to be finite. And because of that, the infinite God will always be both present and imminent in their experience and sharing with them the life they have because of their knowledge of him. But also, he will be way beyond their comprehension, so that there isn't any way they can ever plumb the depths of anything that's true about him. And righteousness is one of those things. So the issue in the righteousness in this text is this question of just exactly how do you treat somebody else so that that other person gets precisely what is due to him in terms of righteousness as it relates to both his identity and his behavior in a cause and effect universe. How should you respond to somebody who does a certain thing? What is the measure that you are to go by? And because that question often escapes, the answer escapes us simply because in order to be able to answer it, you have to have way more knowledge than you can have. That's where the infinite issue comes into play. Without omniscience, you can't even begin to decide how a person ought to be treated unless, I mean, there are some things, like, for example, if Israel goes to God and says, this guy went out on the Sabbath and picked up sticks, what should we do to him? And God said, kill him. Well, if God tells you to do that, well, then you're doing the righteousness of God and giving him what he deserves. But technically, he deserved way more than physical death, but that's all they could do to him for that arrogant rejection of God. Because I don't think any human being ever realizes just how heinous a sin it is to be arrogant toward God. It's indefensible, but it's also enormously wicked. And that's why Paul said that he was the chief of sinners, because he was persecuting God's church. That's just in his mind, and apparently in the mind of God, because that was an inspired claim, inspired by the Spirit. That kind of behavior is just beyond the pale. And we have our categories of little sins and big sins and all the other kind of sins, but I just don't think that ever we come to grips with what it really means to be righteous, because our treatment of somebody else is typically going to be somewhat reactionary depending on what they did and how close we were to the situation. It's amazing how different we'll treat somebody who treats somebody else's kid badly than we will if he treats our kid badly. The penalty would be lots worse if it was our kid. And, you know, that's the kind of thing I'm talking about here when it talks about the issue of exactly just treatment, because it means absolutely no more or less than exact treatment. Not one iota more than is just, and not one iota less than is just. And the degree of detail that's involved in that, I think, was declared by Jesus even in Matthew 12:36, where he said, every idle word that men shall speak, they shall give an account thereof in the day of judgment. Which means that God's judgment of men who reject him is going to be so particularized, the detail is going to be so precise, that every word they ever spoke, every word that came rolling off their tongue, they'll give an answer for. Well, that's pretty That's pretty deep-seated particularization. You can't, I mean, if he's going to judge you for every word, he's probably going to judge you for a lot of things too. So when you start asking, well, just exactly what should happen to somebody who says three or four words they shouldn't have said, as opposed to somebody who said 30 or 40 words that he shouldn't have said, that's the degree of detail. And James even says in James 3:2 that this degree of detail thing is enhanced by the fact that man's particular deficiency and ability to control himself starts with his tongue. Every other member, he says, you can get control of, but nobody can tame the tongue. And so when Jesus and James both put this issue of righteousness in its particularization, where you have to say, okay, is it just to do this to him because he did this? When it gets down to the very words themselves, of course, Jesus is going to be the judge, and with omniscience, he's going to be able to resolve all this because he's perfectly righteous. But who of man could do that? And I said in dealing with this issue of the righteousness of God, one of the things is how you treat somebody based on who he is, that's his identity, and what he's done. That's the recompense as an actor in a cause and effect universe. The whole issue of identity and how you pay somebody back for what they've done, those two things are involved because identity is the quality of man created in the image of God. There are some things that you shouldn't do to somebody else just because he was created in the image of God. And if you violate that identity, then you're guilty and you have some judgment coming. Now, we're talking here about righteousness, and we're not talking about how God's going to deal with his own people at the judgment seat of Christ, but I don't think there'll be any lessening of the degree of evaluation. It may be a little more quick. Hit it with fire and see what burns and what's left. But nonetheless, it'll be a thorough examination of the deeds done in the body, whether good or bad, Paul says. But my point is the issue of a person being in the image of God, even if he's a vile, wicked, heinous criminal, he still has a right to be treated justly. And the issue of being in the image of God is that you're in a very high degree of differentiation from every other created being. That's one thing that bugs me about people and their pets these days. Because we really do treat our dogs and cats and other, what do they call those things, comfort animals? Whatever they, you know, want to take their pet ostrich on the plane because they just can't live without it and all that kind of nonsense. This just drives me nuts. But the reason is because we've been so schooled in this evolutionary concept that there's no difference between a pig and a person. Well, there is. The Bible says a person was created in the image of God, and I don't know what the pig was created in the image of. But anyway, there is no connection. You can slaughter a pig and be absolutely guiltless before God, but you can't even call your man a fool with certain parameters without becoming liable, because Jesus said that. So this is the issue of trying to be just because somebody is in the image of God. And then there is the issue of recompense when you have the idea of repayment for things done, for what they actually did, and then for what they set in motion down the road. Adam and Eve set in motion the entire issue of sin in this creation of human beings. So, obviously, that was a whole lot worse situation than anything anybody's done since, because it was the original insertion of sin into the creation of humanity. But how do you decide that? In the law, you had this, you know, eye for an eye and tooth for a tooth, but we've said many times that's a very squishy concept of righteousness, simply because if an old man pokes out a young man's eye, you can't recompense to him equal justice by poking out his eye, but that's what eye for eye says. But the young man's going to live blind for a lot more years, given the natural length of life, The old man's going to live a very few years blind in one eye. You can't call that equivalent justice. And yet, that's about the best we can do. Eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth, life for life. But there are so many things involved in what's been done and how much damage has been done, or what's been done and how much good has been done. There's an example, for example, in the Old Testament of a king in Israel, which none of those kings were worth being kings. They were all guilty of maintaining the sin of Jeroboam. But there was a king who did some of what God wanted done, and because he did what God wanted to do, he told him, he said, now you're going to have sons sit on the throne in Israel for four generations. There'll be four of your offspring that sit on the throne. That's your reward for having done what I told you to do. But the guy did all kinds of other bad things, so, you know, one of those four didn't live on the throne but just a month or two or three. So, you know, technically the words are fulfilled, but it didn't last very long for that last guy. Anyhow, the point is, when we're talking about the righteousness of God, we're talking about it in light of Hebrews 4:12, where the Word of God pierces to the dividing asunder of joints and marrow, where God's omniscience pierces down to the very detail, the bottom of all the details of everything that's involved, and God alone has the omniscience necessary to the task of determining what is exactly just, since He alone can tell what a man's actions have done, caused, and how they will affect humanity on down the road for years to come. And we shouldn't dismiss that as a arcane concept, because we're told point blankly in the last two or three verses of Second Chronicles that Israel ignored the sabbatical requirement of letting their land lie fallow. And every time they did that, God just kind of wrote it down. And when they had gathered up 70 years worth of obligation to letting the land rest, God said, okay. And He sent them to Babylon to let the land rest for 70 years. Well, the generation that got hauled off to Babylon was the one that paid, but the nation of Israel had been stacking this up, and God wasn't ignoring it. He was just marking time. So, in a sense, we tend to think that, well, you know, we've done the right thing here whenever we've done whatever it is we've done, and the fact might be that we haven't even come close to doing the right thing. And that's the tension. That's what makes the gospel so remarkable, because God is willing to take all of the unrighteous things that we have done, thinking they were done righteously, and cover those so that we don't stand in our own righteous actions. We don't stand on the basis of how well or how perfect we have done things. We stand in the righteousness of the Son of God, who never faltered in either love or faith in all the time He was on the planet. And He offered Himself as a sacrifice so that His righteousness could become ours. That's the issue of the gospel. And that's what Romans 1:16 and 17 is saying. That God is willing to visit upon men His own righteousness if they're willing to trust Him. Paul quotes Habakkuk 2:4 in Romans 1:16 and 17. It's one of the four places in the New Testament you find that verse quoted. There's it three times. It's Romans, Galatians, and Hebrews. I guess it's three times. But anyway, Habakkuk 2:4 particularly says that the gospel presents the righteousness of God as a gift to men. As Habakkuk said, and he quotes Habakkuk, and to quote Habakkuk properly, you need to quote him in order, and that is, the righteous by faith shall live. So it's a statement about not only how you get to be righteous, that is by faith, but what happens to Daniel and his generation being hauled into captivity if they are justified by faith. He said, as a promise, they will live, they will not die. So when Daniel said, I'm not going to eat that meat, he didn't have anything at risk. When Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego said, we're not going to bow to your idol, they didn't have anything at risk. When Daniel said, I'm going to pray to God and ask Him stuff, no matter if the king did say, I can't ask anything from anybody but Him for 30 days. He didn't have anything at risk. Now, whether they were comfortable with the fact that they had nothing at risk depended on the level or degree of their own confidence. I used the illustration this morning. If you have small faith, you'll get what you believe, because God said, if you have faith as grain of mustard seed, God will respond to that faith with whatever it was He promised that you believed Him for. But that doesn't mean your emotional condition will be really up. And I mean, the woman who exercised the mustard seed faith and got healed, she was fearful and tried to hide and didn't want to be confronted by Jesus, and He confronted her anyway. But He told her, don't be afraid. Your faith has delivered you. So, if you believe God, He's going to do what He said. Even if your faith is so weak that it's very, very, very shaky. Shaky faith doesn't produce emotional stability. It just gets God to do whatever He promised He'd do. But on the other hand, if you have great faith and you know that God said He's going to do it this way, and you're firmly confident that He's going to do it this way, well, then you can relax in your circumstances because you expect that God's going to do things the way He said He would. So the centurion had great faith. I don't know if Daniel had such great faith that he didn't have any qualms at all when he was being faced with the lion's den, but I kind of have an idea by that time he had pretty well stabilized. I don't think he had any worries at all when he went in the lion's den. But Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego were younger guys when they had to face the fiery furnace. And I don't know if while they were being hauled up the side of that ramp that dropped so they could be dropped in, I don't know if they were having second thoughts. You know, God, You said we weren't going to die, and now would be a pretty good time to do something about this. And nothing happened until they fell into the fire. That's when the ropes burned off and they didn't even smell like smoke when they came out. There was nothing. The promise was absolutely fulfilled. So all I'm saying is, the issue of faith is an issue that's, you got to grow in this thing in order to develop the emotional stability that gives you peace of mind and all that. But if you believe God, He's going to do what He said. And so in Romans 1, it says the gospel is that God will give you righteousness if you believe in His Son. Believe. Paul called it this. He said it this way at the end of the book of Acts. I preach repentance toward God and faith in Jesus. So you acknowledge your need for God and expect Him to do something, and then you believe that Jesus is the something that He did. And when you do that, you get His righteousness as a gift. This is precisely what the Jews in Israel in Romans 10:3 were ignorant about. They didn't know about this. They didn't have a good concept of this at all. And the reason is because they were blinded by their own legalism and some other things. So we have to deal with the issue or the problem of their ignorance. They didn't know about God's righteousness. And the problem exists, this ignorance and not knowing exists on one level as an ignorance of the infinity of God's righteousness, so that they didn't give enough thought to that as finite creatures. I see this ad all the time on TV about Mutual Omaha and their accident forgiveness policy. And the gist of the advertisement is there's a young lady who comes on and she says, you always pay your insurance on time, and then you have this little fender bender, and then the pain comes because the insurance company raises your rate. And she said, what's the point in having insurance if you get punished for using it? And she said, newsflash. Nobody's perfect. And then Mutual of Omaha comes on with, if you have accident forgiveness, your rate won't be raised. Well, right there are the two issues. Whether you're perfect, whether you need forgiveness. Well, Mutual of Omaha knows you need forgiveness, and this lady knows you're not perfect because nobody's perfect. She says, newsflash, nobody's perfect. Well, every human being on the planet pretty much agrees with that. Until they come to thinking about God. And then all of a sudden, they tend to think that they have the ability to produce an equivalent to God's righteousness that will be acceptable to God. How do you do that when you're not perfect and you need forgiveness? That's the problem. At one level, the Jews would have argued, no, nobody's perfect, and yeah, everybody needs forgiveness. But on another level, they'd say, don't tell me I need a Redeemer. I can perform my own way into heaven. I can do whatever God requires of me. I can meet His demand for a finite equivalent of an infinite righteousness. Well, that's just plumb dumb. But that's the problem of ignorance. Ignorance allows us to think really foolish thoughts. And the problem exists at that level when you're talking about the infinity of God's righteousness. He's the only one who could ever come up with a perfectly holy, infinite righteousness. And yet men tend to think that they can produce some kind of a temporary or finite equivalent of that so as to qualify themselves for acceptance by Him. But the problem also exists on another level, and that's the level of human ignorance of human capacity. Everywhere we turn, we're told that we can do anything we set our minds to, that we can be all we can be, that we can, you know. Men are caught by this tacit awareness that they can't do anything and everything they desire to do just by putting their mind to it. And yet we're told every day, all day long, yeah, you can. And then occasionally we'll have these people that are put on illustration for us that this person overcame these enormous odds and the power of the human spirit and all that kind of stuff. Well, when it comes to human capacity, men need to recognize one thing. They're finite. That means their capacity is limited. And when it comes to righteousness, there is no capacity. Paul said, there is none good, and there is none that doeth righteousness. And the whole problem is, we were plunged into this problem of unrighteousness, and we are subject to it from the get-go, and Jesus said, if you commit sin, you become the slave of it, and slaves don't have the ability to get out of it. And so this is just an amazing level of blindness. And that's what he is saying. They didn't know. They were blind. But there is a more serious problem than their ignorance, and that's in the middle of the verse. They wanted to establish their own. They were seeking to establish their own righteousness. Well, this is an issue of motivation. What did they want to establish their own righteousness for? Why did they want to establish their own righteousness? It wasn't just because they hadn't thought through the implications of the righteousness of God and the demands of the law and their own failures. It had to be more basic than that. I think that the issue is, the text says, Israel wished to establish a righteousness of its own. Well, what does that mean? It meant that there had to be an objective methodological root. There had to be a love and faith root for this desire, this wish. And John declares that this wish is rooted in the arrogance of functional capacity. That's the 1 John 2:16, the pride of life concept. Where if you want to establish your own righteousness, you're simply too proud to admit that you can't do it. You think you can, and so you set about to do it. And the root of this arrogance finds its identification in the offer of the tempter that was made in Genesis 3 to develop the capacities of Elohim. You can be as Elohim. You can be the executor of power for your own life. You don't need God to help you. In fact, you can't trust Him because He said you'd die and you won't die and But the whole point is, he was trying to get them to believe that they were free agents, unfettered by the boundaries set by God upon finite creatures, and they thought they could be gods. They wanted to be gods. That's what seeking to have your own, or to establish their own righteousness is all about, because all that boils down to is, they wanted to establish a foundation so that they could be in control of their own destiny. They could say to God, you owe blessing to me because I have done this right, I've done this right, I've done this right, you owe me. And that's a bigger problem than being ignorant of God's righteousness. It comes out of that ignorance, but nonetheless, there's this perverse motivation. And Paul says this was their root. And he says the outcome of it was that they didn't subject themselves to the righteousness of God, which that word subject means they weren't willing to put themselves under it. That's rebellion. It's actually high-handed. Paul's statement that Israel refused to submit to the righteousness of God is a statement about how little they cared about what it was going to cost God to provide him with this perfect righteousness. In other words, they despised the cross. They hated the thought that anybody, especially them, could be bad enough to require a price that heavy to be forgiven. If it required the death of the Son of God to enable me to be forgiven for the words that I speak out of my mouth that are not worthy words, then that makes the words that I speak out of my mouth extremely bad, wicked to the core, because it requires the death of the Son of God Himself in order to make it possible for justice to be satisfied. Well, the Jews were absolutely not going to admit that they were that bad. They just were not. So, Paul actually says, the refusal was not a refusal to be subject to God's righteousness so much as it was a rejection of the gospel's offer of the righteousness of God based on Habakkuk 2:4. In other words, the Jews rejected Paul's gospel because it required of them that they admit their depravity. They would glibly say, yeah, nobody's perfect, but they would not say, I am an unforgivable sinner unless God does something enormously significant. My sins have qualified me to perish forever was something they didn't want to hear. They didn't want to say it. When they prayed, they said, Lord, I fast 3 times a day. I pray long prayers. I tithe of my mint and cumin and dill and all. I am doing all of this stuff because this is the right kind of thing for me to do to be accepted before you. And God's sitting in heaven saying, how in the world can you possibly think that meets the requirements of righteousness in your life? So the refusal was actually a result, according to verse 33 of chapter 9, of having stumbled over the stone of stumbling and being offended by the rock of offense. All through both testaments, God made clear that the cross as a sacrifice of the Son of God for sinners is the highest of all themes of divine revelation, and the Jews simply turned their noses up at it. They were offended by the very idea that they would require a sacrifice of that magnitude because of their behavior. Ah, we're not that bad. That was at the root of their sharp antagonism toward Paul and the gospel. And it shows up in the rage in the end of the days where the prophecies are being fulfilled, where God is pouring out His wrath upon the world because of their rebellion and high-handed arrogance. It says, even though they suffered all these things, yet they would not repent. And that is such an incomprehensible thing. What in the world is wrong with saying, I have sinned? Get you off the hook. Because acknowledgement of sin is the first thing that God requires. And once we acknowledge that we have a need for Him, then we can turn to Him and see if He's provided a solution. And of course, the gospel provides that. So this statement in verse 30 of Romans 10 is an unveiling of the heart of Israel and their strong antagonism toward God. And it shows that Jesus was right when He said, you're not Abraham's seed. You're of your father, the devil. Because the devil rages against God every day, 24/7. His anger is intense hostility. And there's no basis for it. No legitimate basis for it. He is raging against God because God refuses to let Him be the God. And that's exactly the same situation that the Jews are in. They raged against Christ, accused Him of being of the devil, when they, in fact, were of the devil.